This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, October 7th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Last month, The Wall Street Journal began publishing a series of reports that they called the Facebook Files. Based on leaked internal documents, the series highlights how Facebook has stoked fear, anger, and division in order to increase user engagement, and then failed to effectively fight the spread of misinformation and the use of its platform to exploit and abuse vulnerable communities around the world. This week, the whistleblower who supplied the internal Facebook documents to the Wall Street Journal revealed herself. Frances Haugen is a data engineer who worked at Facebook from 2019 to 2021. On Tuesday, she testified before a group from the Senate Commerce Committee about how decisions were made at the biggest social media platform in the world.
During my time at Facebook, first working as the lead product manager for civic misinformation and later on counter-espionage, I saw Facebook repeatedly encounter conflicts between its own profits and our safety. Facebook consistently resolved these conflicts in favor of its own profits. The result has been more division, more harm, more lies, more threats, and more combat. In some cases, this dangerous online talk has led to actual violence that harms and even kills people.
Andrew Morantz, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss Haugen's testimony and the potential effects on the company. Hey, Andrew, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm actually in the office studio today.
I know, and I was there last week. So progress is being made, we hope.
We hope.
This is not the first testimony we've seen about Facebook malfeasance. Mark Zuckerberg himself has been hauled before Congress twice in 2018 and 2020. Let's just go back. What were the concerns then, and how did he claim he would address them?
Well, even when Mark Zuckerberg was a Harvard student who was just sort of messing around with ranking women's appearances before he even made Facebook, there have been concerns about privacy. There have been concerns about data. There have been concerns about what social media is doing to us both personally and sociologically. The more recent set of concerns, as far as the government goes, is Facebook too big? Is it too powerful? Does it need to be broken up? And more broadly, is it sort of an existential threat to democracy, to our ability to constrain things like pandemics? Is it making people more violent? Is it making society more of a tinderbox? So it's a whole range of stuff, some of which can be dealt with governmentally and some of which, frankly, can't.
So it sounds like you, too, learned quite a bit from the journal's key findings. Maybe talk a little bit about those and then how Haugen made the committee and the public understand exactly what is so dangerous about Facebook's platforms.
Yeah, well, so a big part of my experience of reading the Wall Street Journal coverage and some of the documents that Haugen made public was just a sort of almost a sigh of relief that I hadn't been getting the story wrong, because you talk to all these former employees about how the algorithms promote engagement above all else, which sort of drives people toward the most incendiary content, about how there's separate sets of rules for normal Facebook users and for VIP Facebook users like Donald Trump or like celebrities or, you know, Bolsonaro or any number of other people. And, you know, you report that stuff and you know, you feel very confident that your sourcing is solid and that you've, you know, seen certain things. But reading the full scope of these thousands and thousands of pages that, you know, by far the biggest leak from within Facebook that has ever occurred, it was mostly just sort of seeing these things be confirmed again and again and again, not in Haugen's words, but in the words of Facebook's researchers. They sent research teams inside the company to go find out what was happening. And again and again and again, these researchers came back and said, this stuff is just as toxic as we thought. We are letting celebrities and politicians get away with hate speech and revenge porn and all these things that are against our rules. We are driving teen girls to depression and suicidality. We are, you know, on and on and on down the list. And so to someone who pays close attention, not a lot of it was totally out of the blue shocking, but it was kind of a confirmation that, you know, even though when you put out a story like this, Facebook tries to spin and walk things back and obfuscate, and they try to tell you that, you know, they try to gaslight you essentially into thinking you're getting the story wrong. And this was just a massive confirmation that, you know, the notion that Facebook is as toxic as we all thought has essentially been right all along.
And what was revealed about Facebook's actions after the 2016 election, what precautions it made and then lifted?
Well, so there were a few things. One thing is this metric they call MSI, for meaningful social interactions. And a lot of what they do is, so, you know, when you log into Facebook's newsfeed, you're not seeing a chronological list of everything that everyone you're friends with has posted, no matter how boring it was. You know, this person changed her profile photo, that person got a haircut, whatever. The point of the newsfeed algorithm is to rank it not in that way that would be boring and that would maybe cause you to log off, but in a way that would be maximally likely to cause you to engage with it. So it'll show you your ex-boyfriend's wedding photos. It'll show you your political opponent's most incendiary views. It is trying to maximize certain emotions that will get you to click or share or comment. And so they're always tweaking the engagement-based rankings, as they're called, to try to toggle between making you the most excited, which would extract the most short-term attention and profit from you, while not making you into such a tinderbox that you're going to go, you know, riot or storm the Capitol or something, which then might be bad PR for Facebook. So in 2018, they changed their newsfeed algorithm yet again to prioritize what they called meaningful social interactions, or MSI, as I said. What they said was the purpose of this was to, you know, we hear that people don't want as much polarizing news content. They want to hear more from their friends and family. You know, we want to get back to our original purpose of bringing everyone closer together. And of course, in a press release, this all sounds sort of nice and warm and fuzzy. But even if you're getting a post from your uncle or your neighbor, that could still be shocking or terrifying or outrageous. So it's not as if misinformation and these high activation emotions went away with this algorithm shift. If anything, some of the evidence suggests that it got worse. And part of this is suggesting that these problems are not one or two tweaks away from being solved. They're really baked into Facebook's business model and its entire kind of core reason for existing.
And there's something Trumpian, it seems to me, in all of their public talk about bringing communities together and then what they're actually doing, which is setting people against each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's Trumpian in the sense that it's fundamentally a lie. I mean, you know, it's not the case that no one is brought together by Facebook, right? Of course, social media has wrought a lot of positive changes in the world. You know, Me Too was a hashtag. Black Lives Matter was a hashtag. You know, you've seen in recent days, and the whistleblower Frances Haugen has made this analogy over and over to Facebook being like a tobacco company. And I actually don't think that's quite the right analogy, because tobacco does nothing but harm people and kill people. It doesn't have any social benefit. I would argue that it's less like a tobacco company and more like a fossil fuel company, in the sense that oil and coal, you know, they have short-term benefits. They help us keep our lights on and power our cars and trains and all that stuff. But in the long term, in aggregate, they're killing us and destroying our planet, right? So you kind of have to weigh both in your mind. Yes, Facebook does connect people and help people sell their couches to their neighbors and help people have businesses and all these things. It's just that the fact that there are benefits doesn't mean that we can't take seriously and try to mitigate the, in my view, much bigger harms.
I also find it interesting. There was a Pew Research Center study last year that found about 2/3 of Americans believing that social media companies exacerbate negative trends in this country. So why do so many people continue to use Facebook? Is it an addiction? Is it that they find that the benefits outweigh even the things that scare them about it?
So yes, there is an addictive quality. And some of these leaked documents show in great detail how even, you know, let's say teenage girls who know in some sense that Instagram is making them feel bad about themselves and their bodies and all that, they still report feeling addicted to the service and unable to stop using it. And I would argue, just knowing how human beings work, that there are probably even more people who aren't admitting to themselves that they're addicted, but they are in some sense addicted. Now, I think it goes even deeper than that, right? Because part of the antitrust argument and part of just the casual understanding that we all have about Facebook and social media more generally is that no matter how much you may know that in aggregate it might be bad for society abstractly, you still might need or think you need to be on there. There are a lot of things we do that we feel that we need to do or that we feel are in our short-term interest, even though in aggregate they're bad for us, right? And then there's just another element to it as well, which is there are ways that we act that are with our sort of what Daniel Kahneman would call our fast brain that are not in line with what our slow brain would have us do. So people might say on a survey, I really ought to watch less TV, or I really ought to use less social media, or I really ought to eat less McDonald's. But they don't necessarily do those things, right? And so I don't think it's entirely up to individual agency to fix these problems. I think, you know, if you went into every grocery store in the country and every visible aisle was just only stocked with Twinkies and Oreos and, you know, rat poison, and, you know, you had to go on a huge scavenger hunt to find, you know, lettuce, and then we blamed everybody in America for not eating well, you know, sure, there's individual agency there, but there's also a kind of structural market problem.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
How did Zuckerberg himself respond to this? He's been so unwilling to apologize publicly. What did he do this time?
Well, I think his tone has really, really shifted. There was a long, long tradition, a kind of much mocked tradition of Zuckerberg and other Facebook executives issuing the same kind of apologies again and again. You know, we're sorry, we messed up, we take this very seriously, we're going to work to regain your trust. And then essentially, you know, I'm oversimplifying, but essentially nothing would change. And over time, we know from reporting in the New York Times and other places, the perception among Zuckerberg and some of his inner circle was, why do we keep doing this apology thing? It's not even working. You know, the public still doesn't like us. They're still giving us this torrent of criticism. Why don't we just stop apologizing and you know, go on the offense, or what was described in that piece as a more aggressive defense. And, you know, I would argue that they're sort of missing the point, right? That instead of saying, maybe people keep criticizing us because we keep doing the same things that are deleterious and that we don't actually solve the problems, but that's not the lesson they took away. The lesson they took away was, why are we even apologizing in the first place? So now there's really this kind of no more Mr. Nice Guy approach from Mark Zuckerberg. His post in response on his own Facebook page in response to this week of scandals has been really much more defiant than we've seen in the past. He's using words like illogical, saying that, you know, the claims of the whistleblower don't really make sense. You know, at this point, he is just trying to rally his own troops. He's trying to keep his own employees morale high and trying to say, you know, ignore the haters, essentially, and, you know, let's keep pressing on building the best services in the world, and, you know, people will keep using it and the stock price will keep going up. And so I think he's, at least for now, he's kind of done placating the public because it hasn't worked. And so instead of taking in the criticism and taking it seriously and looking square in the face into the question of whether he is in fact morally beyond the pale, he is just sort of seems to be ignoring it.
So as far as I can tell, Congress has done virtually nothing, despite, you know, the earlier testimony by Zuckerberg. Could you bring us up to date, though, on the FTC's lawsuit against Facebook for monopolistic practices?
Yeah. So the FTC, for decades, really, has been pretty reluctant to break up big companies, especially when, like Facebook, they are companies that are not seen as, you know, hiking up prices. So, you know, if people are price gouging, then maybe we'll take action. But if the consumer is getting a good price, we'll be inclined to let it ride. And of course, Facebook is free. So there hasn't been an argument that Facebook is price gouging. They're doing much more subtle and in many ways more invidious things by, you know, monopolizing and, you know, monetizing people's attention and data. But that until now hasn't really been cognizable as an antitrust issue. So Lina Khan, who's the new head of the FTC, who is really sees antitrust very differently and has made her name by taking a very starkly new academic approach to a more vigorous style of antitrust enforcement, she brought this claim to the FTC saying, Facebook is a monopoly in the world of personal social networking, not professional social networking like LinkedIn, and not sort of public broadcasting like Twitter, but this specifically defined market of personal social media. And a judge batted it down and said, you haven't made your case. And then the FTC brought back a more fleshed out, more robust claim where they brought in more evidence. Look, it's very clear, and the judge even admitted this. The judge said, when you hear that there's a movie called The Social Network, you don't wonder which social network they're talking about, right? So everyone knows that Facebook is dominant. The question is, can you make a technical legal case that it is, in fact, a monopoly in a particularly defined market? And what would you do in response to that? And I think the most low-hanging fruit response would be to undo Facebook's acquisitions of companies like Instagram and WhatsApp. Facebook argues that that would send a signal to businesses that even though those acquisitions were approved at the time, even an approved merger can be undone at any time, and that would seem capricious. But I think the basic fact of Facebook's size and dominance is not in question. The question is just, where is there a legal toehold?
And then there's maybe the biggest question of all, which is how you regulate Facebook's business, privacy, and safety practices without undermining free speech. So I wonder what you make of the stakes right now when COVID-19 misinformation on Facebook is arguably, as President Biden said this summer, killing people.
So on the one hand, you have people, and I have sometimes been among them, who say, of course, free speech is important. And of course, we need to protect it. But we also need to recognize that free speech has very real world effects. You know, COVID denial is a great example of this. That doesn't mean that free speech isn't cherished and that it shouldn't exist and that it shouldn't be protected very vigorously, especially in terms of restricting government power. I believe all those things to be true. But I also believe that that doesn't mean that you can just ignore what happens as a result of that speech, right? Facebook has made a very, very stark and public decision to double down on this notion of kind of essentially free speech absolutism, of saying, you know, anything you do to restrict us is a blow against the cherished notion of free speech. And I just don't think that's true. I think you yourself, Facebook, have said that you want to be a leader in the fight against COVID misinformation. Your platform is having demonstrably the opposite effect in the world. What are you going to do about it? That's, yes, free speech is involved in that question, but it's not as cut and dry as saying COVID deniers have their right to free speech. Sure, they do, but it's not that simple. And Facebook has its own rules that provide a much higher bar than the First Amendment of the Constitution does. They're just not always good at enforcing them. That said, I do worry very much about, you know, congressional hearings where you hear senators and people throwing around ideas like, you know, let's have a government agency to regulate misinformation. That gets into, I think, pretty Orwellian territory. So I don't think you can say free speech allows anyone to do anything and we don't have to worry about the consequences. I obviously think that's a flawed argument. But nor do I think that you can say, let's just have the government ride in on a white horse and, you know, tell us what we should think and what we should be allowed to post. Obviously, that's a terrible slippery slope as well. So I don't want, you know, power flowing to the government or to Mark Zuckerberg to make these choices. I think that there needs to be an entirely new system, frankly.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, I don't think we've really started to imagine it yet. I mean, I don't think that, I think honestly, we're just going to have a cultural shift where we learn how to use the internet in a healthier and better way. I mean, I know that's extremely vague because I don't know what it's going to look like and I don't think anyone does, but I think the first step is conceiving of it in broad enough terms. I mean, I think we're so small bore with this stuff sometimes where we say, you know, should we change this or that part of the algorithm or should we tweak this or that part of the terms of service, when I think really we need to start thinking much more broadly.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Andrew Marantz is a New Yorker staff writer and the author of Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.